This tavern was actually super influential on Martin Van Buren when he was growing up, because the taverns at the time, don't forget the American Revolution started in a tavern in Boston for all intents and purposes.
Right.
And this bar that his parents owned became a meeting spot for Federalists and Jeffersonian Republicans to mingle and often argue. And, you know, early on, you know, sometimes he would call this his practical education, right? He saw political talk, how patronage works, how coalition works. Young Martin Van Buren is sitting there helping serve these guys beers and listening to them argue.
Welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, Season 2, podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. And yes, that means all the presidents, not just Andrew Jackson. I am Kyle, the Dick Johnson to Eric Mason's Levy Woodbury. And if you don't get that joke, please keep listening, because by the end of this episode, if you don't understand it by then, we have failed miserably. Remember to sub, like, and comment on your platform of choice. First person to get the timestamp when Eric's stroke begins will get our respect, and nothing is more valuable than that.
Yeah, and just a quick plug. We're still waiting to get enough people so we can design and send out the notebooks.
Oh, the journals. That's right. Journals, yes.
Yeah, we want to encourage more John Quincy. I guess we're only really one president away from that. Like, so we record so far ahead. Sometimes I feel like time shifts. Oh, my God. I'm talking about an episode that's going to burn me. It's freaking Martin Van Buren. I feel like I have been, you know, after John Quincy Adams, I feel like he was my safe space. And I feel like I've just entered a world of chaos, you know, drafting up these scripts.
It's an era of chaos. It's not just like chaos. It's not just one or two presidents. Like, there's a dearth.
And how does it end? Civil War.
Yep.
And the first presidential assassination.
Was that the first?
I believe so. It wasn't the first attempted, but I think Abraham Lincoln was first to be assassinated in office. William A. Harrison was first to die in office.
Oh, okay. I think that's where I was going.
I wonder who was the first.
Zachary Taylor, wasn't he one? What happened to him?
I thought he died of like tuberculosis or something like that.
TB, man.
Yeah, because like tuberculosis just killed a lot of humanity for a very, very long time. And then we like recently, in the last 100 years, we're like, never mind.
All right, so where do you want to start with our first Dutch overlord?
No, now you're hurting my brain, because
that is Abraham Lincoln. You're right.
Okay, no. On the what did Zachary Taylor die of? Zachary Taylor. We're gonna have fun with Zachary Taylor because he has a very interesting life, especially on the slavery issue. He's, you know, I think we do a good job on the show of like talking about that. They thought he was assassinated. He was one who ate lot of milk and cherries, and then died. Zachary Taylor's a very, very just interesting. He's actually one of those presidents. I mean, he was only in for like 2 years, but it is actually quite interesting. Unlike Martin Van Buren, because all we got was less charismatic Andrew Jackson. That is who we're talking about today. We're talking about less charismatic Dutch speaking Andrew Jackson.
The first Dutch overlord.
The first. That's an implication. There's a second.
Is there?
No, I don't think so.
Not yet. The sequel is yet to come.
It's funny because Martin Van Buren didn't get along with John Quincy Adams, but John Quincy Adams like spoke Dutch fluently. And Martin Van Buren was the only president who English wasn't his first language. It was he grew up in a Dutch household.
So who spoke the other person's language better? Did Martin Van Buren speak better English, or did John Quincy Adams speak better Dutch?
Oh, I'd put all my money on John Quincy Adams speaking Dutch better than Van Buren speaks English.
That makes me happy.
I just have this funny thing, because like, we don't have recordings for that back then, but it must have been very funny. I feel like if we had recordings back then, he wouldn't have won the election, because people are like, I'm not voting for this Dutch guy. Yeah, this Dutch guy running for president.
Imagine the debate.
What did this guy just say? Like,
said he wanted to fix the economy?
Yeah, everything. That was everything sounding like a question. Why are your shoes made of wood? Weird guy. Martin Van Buren, so he's we're now officially out of anybody who's involved in the revolution. In fact, Martin Van Buren was born after the revolution.
Right.
He was born December 5th, 1782.
Geppetto, I think it was.
I have to Abraham and somebody named Maria Hose.
Oh, you mean his biological parents. I meant his sculptor.
It's a Fuffin. That was a good one. I was like, what the hell is he doing? Yeah. I'm like, I thought that was an Italian name, but
I felt really good about that one.
I did. I took Italian for 3 years. Did very okay in it. So he's born in New York, and he's born to Abraham Van Buren, who's a farmer, but he also ran a tavern. So Martin Van Buren grew up like working at a tavern, essentially as like a barback, which I think is kind of cool. And Maria Hose Van Buren, Hoes. I sent a text to one of my buddies who speaks Dutch to how is that pronounced, and he just didn't respond back to me. So I don't know if he looked at it and was like,
it's probably something vulgar.
Yeah, he's probably just angry at me.
Yeah, he's like, what did you call me?
One of my favorite ones is her full name, because you know they include the maiden name, like as like kind of the middle name, which would be Maria Hose Van Allen Van Buren, and that's too many Vans.
That's way too many Vans.
Way too many Vans. It's actually it's too many Vans or not enough Vans.
It's more Vans than a Mormon family.
more Vans than a shoe shop. Martin Van Buren primarily spoke Dutch in his childhood. And it's when you read about it, it sounds like it's just like his parents spoke Dutch to him a lot. But he actually grew up in a community that was predominantly Dutch speaking. It was a kind of a Dutch primary speaking village in Columbia County, New York. It's actually in a place called Kinderhook, which is like...
Kinder.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like that sounds like some Dutch people would name where they live. And it's kind of funny.
But it sounds interesting to me. It sounds like the community thing like never really changed. Like we see that now where like you have communities of like when the Italians and Irish and all those are coming over, they all lived in like the same neighborhoods in like Chicago. So like none of that's really changed over the years.
Right. Like we have the north end of Boston, which is predominantly Italian. Then Southie, which is... Well, Southie's changed a lot in the last 30 years, but it's predominantly like Irish.
Right.
So one of the random facts in history is the first president to be born an American citizen didn't speak English. Dutch. Okay. And if that's not the most American thing in the world, I don't know what is. Right. That is awesome. It's funny to think that the first guy to become president who was born a U.S. citizen didn't speak English. That
makes perfect sense.
They'd been great if he came in and enforced Dutch as the official national language.
Oh, my God, right? Or just started, like, reopening the Dutch West Indies or something.
Yeah. Ooh. Immediately right? swerved to colonialism. Right. Made it 7 years. But, you know, this tavern was actually super influential on Martin Van Buren when he was growing up, because the taverns at the time, don't forget the American Revolution started in a tavern in Boston for all intents and purposes.
Right.
And this bar that his parents owned became a meeting spot for Federalists and Jeffersonian Republicans to mingle and often argue. And, you know, early on, you know, sometimes he would call this his practical education, right? He saw political talk, how patronage works, how coalition works. I mean, at this time, it's important to remember that, you know, this is right when the Constitution is being drafted, this idea of, you don't really see Jeffersonian Republicans at this point, but you definitely see that early Jeffersonian Republican, and you see your traditional Federalists trying to hash out the Constitution. Young Martin Van Buren is sitting there helping serve these guys beers and listening to them argue over.
Does he understand any of it, though? He said he's speaking Dutch.
He was crazy intelligent. Like,
yeah.
Oh yeah. As much as I'm going to constantly refer to him as Jackson's puppet, and I think that wasn't an accident by Van Buren, by the way. I don't think Van Buren was tricked into being Jackson's patsy. I think Martin Van Buren believed it.
You think he actually like believed what he was doing as opposed to just selling his soul out for, I guess, the presidency?
Yeah, I think he was a true Jacksonian. I think he was genuine in that belief. I just think he didn't really set his own agenda till we see the divorce bill. And that's in like the 17
divorce bill.
Yeah, the divorce bill. We'll talk about it. The divorce bill is very interesting. It's actually a huge piece of economic legislation that was hard time passed, got reversed by the Whigs, and the Whigs later on were like, that was actually a wicked good idea, and then reinstituted it.
And how often does that happen in history?
Like, never.
Right.
It's still widely attributed to how banking existed in the 1900s. It's considered a foundational piece. I don't want to say true modern banking, because modern banking's got to take a little bit of a different turn. But if you think of like banking during in the 1900s in America, it was kind of what set the stage for it. So And kudos to Mr. Van Buren, because that was not something Jackson would have been okay with. In many ways, Martin Van Buren is to Jackson what Madison was to Jefferson, except
it's like a protege that broached. Did he eventually like break off and have his own ideas and push his own agenda?
No, he's Madison in the first term. I wonder if Van Buren had a second term, if he would have strayed further away from Jackson. But so again, as I goof around with this, I do want to be like sincere. And, you know, what we always try to do on the show is give an honest interpretation of like who these presidents were. And we can't, you know, again, the purpose of the show is to make people curious about the presidents, right? We can't in an hour in good faith talk about everything under the sun.
Also, we try to get to like just understand like some of the idea, like what the people behind the decisions, right? Like what influenced him early on in his life to make the decisions he made later on.
Yeah, and the other thing about Martin Van Buren is his, he came from very, very humble means. One of the things I find really funny when you're learning about these presidents is you're starting to see them not necessarily because of how we start out. We don't see them as presidents, right? That's how we, like, our introduction to them is them being, like, the most powerful person in politics in the country.
Right.
And obviously, as we get to later presidents, the most powerful people in the world. You know, we do take a chronological approach. So, like, we start off learning about them as kids, as you know, people who come from a family and a small
or
business
lost the family,
Jackson lost the family. I find Martin. I kind of look I want to say associate. I kind of get Martin Van Buren because I grew up in a small business family. I worked from a young age in a family business, and I think it's really cool to see somebody who came to know all these prominent people. Because he served them beer. Like, I met a lot of interesting people growing up pumping gas. So as much as I'm like, oh, I don't like Martin Van Buren because he was just like Jackson 2.0, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's a funny narrative. But it really isn't, though. Like, he was a person. He was like a person who grew up hardworking. And unlike a lot of the presidents, he didn't have college training. But he became a lawyer.
So one of the things I think that really stands out with this program, and I think what we've been doing, or at least the journey that we've been on so far, is that I've been finding that there may be presidents that I vehemently disagree with it, especially on a moral level. But I've always, every president we've talked about, I found something, some trait that's admirable about them. And I find that to be fascinating. Like, that's not, I don't know. You can get sucked in and just look at the bad if that's all you want to look at. But there's also some good in there too. And I think it's interesting that we're able to kind of, I don't know, not to be so blinded by the bad that we don't see some of the cool things that happen.
Yeah, exactly. So Van Buren has this non-privileged upbringing. His father did own. He did have several enslaved people who worked the farm. We never shy away from that here. Van Buren,
he looked interesting. I was seeing a little bit about this to where it looked like his views actually did evolve over his lifetime, but I don't know if that happened during the presidency.
Yeah. It actually happened before. So Martin Van Buren himself owned one slave in his life. It was a gentleman named Tom, and Tom, self-emancipated. Which I love that term, by the way.
Okay, yeah. This is the Tom incident.
Yeah, and this is in 1814, and he self-emancipated means he left. He was just like, screw you guys. Right. And he moved to Worcester, Massachusetts. So shout out Massachusetts, again, being on the right side of history.
Right.
Endlessly being on the right side of history outside of like three things. you're welcome for the internet. Like, hey, you guys are all welcome that you're listening to this because some brainiac in Massachusetts, who probably wasn't even from Massachusetts, but went to MIT, was like, what if computers could talk to each other? like, oh,
yeah. Was that Al Gore?
I'm going to be able to buy so much awful stuff on Amazon because of this guy. Martin Van Buren got a letter from this gentleman, I don't know if I want to call him a gentleman, this guy Alonzo Hammond, and he reported Tom was living in, if you're reporting where free slaves living, you're a piece of crap. So he got this letter from this piece of crap Alonzo Hammond. If you're a descendant of this guy and you don't like me disparaging your great 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 grandfather, write me. I will argue with you. I will email the show.
Argue with you.
Yes. Get a new grandparent. And so he said, hey, Tom's living in Worcester. which is how it's pronounced, not Worcester.
Worcestershire.
And, you know, all Martin Van Buren wrote back was, he replied, I'm going to the exact quote, if it could be caught without violence, he offered $50. And one of the historians I have who wrote it just wrote, no recapture followed, and Tom remained free, which means I just like Alonso probably knocked on the door because he's a piece of crap. Hey, do you want to go back to Van Buren? And he was just like, no. And he's like, all right. This guy just lived the rest of his life free in Massachusetts.
See, that's funny though, because the spin that I saw on that was almost like Martin Van Buren didn't really pursue it.
No, and that's kind of true.
But that's not true, no. If you say if it can be done without violence, that's not pursuing it. That's just, I don't want to pursue it that hard. Yeah.
Yes, it's laziness.
Yes.
Now, he did have slaves and he was in the White House, but this is a little interesting side note we're going to get on. I always love the first episode because it gives us a little more flexibility to talk about this. There's this like misnomer that like there were at this point in U.S. history, there was like presidents were being slaves to the White House. And that might've been like kind of true. Like Paul Jennings was a slave, obviously, who did actually work to the White House a little bit under Jefferson. Obviously numerous of cases under Madison, of slaves being in the White House. But when we talk about slaves, like maintaining the building, not being like, you know, not like serving the president and stuff like that. There were actually slaves who were rented to the White House from surrounding plantations. So like the White House didn't like the U.S. government didn't like own the slaves who worked on there. Doesn't make it any better. It's still like treating people like tools, which is messed up.
Even worse than that, not only that, you're renting slaves. So you're paying somebody else for somebody else's labor.
Yes. I'm not weighing an opinion on that. I'm just saying like important like misconception in history that may sway somebody's opinion.
Did John Quincy Adams let that slide? Because I don't think he
did. They wouldn't give John Quincy Adams or John Adams slaves. So they'd be like, oh, we should free these people and educate them.
Yes.
Because that's what they did. Because the Adamses were honestly the only good people who were president to Lincoln. Right. Is that a bad take?
I thought there was at least one or two in there that between.
Hold on,
that
let me think. Who would terrible. I think they all owned slaves at one point up until Lincoln. Hmm. We gotta look into that. I'm pretty sure I looked this up during when I was writing one of these scripts.
We'll get to it eventually, right?
Yeah. No, but they're definitely by number eight, we are. I'm fine saying
all
that.
But two, yeah.
Yeah. Dude, that's wild if you think about that. It took 16 and three out of the 16 first presidents.
And you think that more of them would change their mind too. That's the thing that blows my mind.
You know, you think if you were, you know, swearing an oath about upholding a, you know, that everybody has a right to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, or when Jefferson said pursuit of property, you'd be like, I think that's everybody.
I mean, I guess if we consider people property, then life, liberty, pursuit of property.
And I like that they made Jackson made like John Quincy Adams to be the guy out of touch with people. And it's like, no, he's just like everybody has the right. And as we'll get to in Van Buren's presidency, he was very angry at John Quincy Adams, who argued the Amistad case. And Martin Van Buren argued that the Mende people should have been returned to Spain because they were just cargo.
Right.
Just a horrible
take.
Just like the worst. And that's why John Quincy, like, honestly, if somebody can point out one thing that John Quincy Adams' viewpoint doesn't still stand up to today, I'm out. I will argue. What is it?
Funding the Hollow Earth expedition.
You think he should have funded it?
No, I was saying that's a weird thing to do.
He funded the exploration of the Arctic. I'm going to argue with you.
I know. We talked to me the whole short on that.
Yeah. Larry's like, stop. So at around 14 years old, Martin Van Buren leaves his family and he goes and becomes a lawyer through something called apprenticeship. So he leaves and he does this program to basically where he shadows this attorney, Peter Van Schaack, who lives in Kinderhook. So he didn't leave the area. But I think it's really cool here because he didn't go to college because his family didn't have the resources or money to do that. So he was like, well, I want to be an attorney. And at this time in history, you can become an attorney by being an apprentice. And he becomes an attorney. What's kind of cool is that while he's apprenticing under Peter Van Schaack, he actually ends up like running with a group of people who are both, you know, your traditional Jeffersonians. I'm not even going to call them Jeffersonian Republicans. They're just pure Jeffersonians at this point, because we're in like 1796. Like the hairs are already starting to split on here. And pure Federalists, and he becomes, because he's in New York too. So he's this is one of the Southerners, right? This is only our third Northern president, and to be honest with you, it's only really our second family that's from the North. And you can make a little argument about Monroe, but Monroe was Virginian, even though he died in New York. He definitely became more cosmopolitan later in his life.
Monroe felt more Northern than Southern, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, I was in the South for a little bit, and I don't know any Van Buren's.
Right.
But, so he ends up having, this is kind of cool. So he gets this reputation for being overly careful, always focused on technical legal reasoning. That's a term that would pop up a lot in how contemporaries would describe him. And he also was known to be very stoic. So he wasn't overly flamboyant. He believed in like these very rote, rational arguments that were confined to the law. And he was known for just exercising a lot of precaution in the risk he would take, which is funny because that's almost the complete opposite of Jackson. this really built him up, dude. This really made people look at him and be like, wow, this is a really intelligent man who speaks multiple languages and comes from work. And he always kept that working class family attitude. So he doesn't come from these crazy means. And so that turned off a lot of the aristocracy to him, but he's not in Virginia.
Right.
He's in New York. And so there's a little bit of that attitude that even exists to this day, where New Yorkers kind of like that bootstrapping. And he ends up moving to New York City, and he keeps training under this guy, under this attorney, William Van Ness. Everybody has a van in this story, right? Like, everybody has a van. We're going to... interesting enough, Van Ness is an ally, big-time ally, big-time supporter, big with Aaron Burr, the second vice president, the third vice president. Obviously, Aaron Burr killed Alexander Hamilton. And so he gets exposed to the whole Burr organization and this whole idea, like, you know, this political machine, right? This party machine that is a party machine. Sounds way funnier than what I'm trying to describe. I don't mean like Buds McKenzie. I mean like
that's such a good reference.
I mean, I think our age demographics they'll land pretty well.
I hope so.
But this idea of like an electorate machine that's able to put people into office, and Van Buren is just kind of like obsessed with this. Not in a way where he's like, not in a way that he's like, this is the greatest thing in the world. That the fact that people from all these different factions could come behind and vote for one person, because they all kind of benefited more by combining force and electing this one person than if they all kind of just rationally acted alone. And to be honest with you, it sounds a lot like an economist. It sounds
Nash's paper, doesn't it? Almost.
Yeah. The prisoner's dilemma, right? Yeah. Like, the Nash equilibrium.
Yeah.
I love it. Very fun to teach. I look into the eyes of Van Buren, who's known for being the stoic, calculating. When I say calculating, I don't mean like empty. He wasn't an empty guy. He wasn't like, you know, empty behind the eyes.
And stoic, I think, is another term that gets misused too. Like, that just means you don't show your emotions. It doesn't mean you don't have them, right?
Like Marcus Aurelius was a barracks general during, barracks emperor during the Roman Empire. I mean, that man is, the guy who wrote that was somebody who wasn't exactly known just for sitting there quietly. It's exactly what you said. It's no emotion. So by 1803, he returns to the Upper Hudson Valley, which is where Kinderhook, Hudson, all those areas are. And he opens a partnership with his half-brother, James. And they, you know, quickly become known for being, like, very hard to win a case against, because they were known for being incredibly meticulous and unassuming. Like, they would roll in there. They would explain to the jury, to the judge, exactly the correct position, as they would call it. And they would kind of not get involved in, like, the emotional side of jurying, I think at the time is what they called it, the idea of, like, I guess we'd eventually call it, like, jury psychology. Yeah. And it proved to be ruthlessly effective, especially in business negotiations. Yeah.
It's funny because personal anecdotes usually do a better job of swaying people than raw facts and data. So I wonder how he was so successful in it in this situation.
Yeah, I do think raw facts and figures, when presented in a certain way, can be very diffusing to emotional arguments.
Yeah.
Especially if you are somebody who can't walk that very thin line between passion and emotional. Like, if you're passionate, people love that. People love passion. People hate emotions. People do not like that. So I think, but if you're just somebody, here's what happened, and you can kind of relay that to the jury, especially in an unassuming manner, a lot of people just take that as fact. A lot of presentation, I give a lot of presentations.
Yeah, presentation, that's a good point, because the way, if you can present it matter-of-factly, not even deign to argue back, there's almost this is the truth. It's so true, I don't even have to argue with you. That presentation in and of itself, I think, is pretty powerful.
So I do think that was a lot of Van Buren style during that time.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
And so he starts defining himself as a Jeffersonian at this point, which a lot of Jacksonians, especially younger Jacksonians, remember, he's only in his early 20s at this point. And he actually ends up attaching to something called the Bucktail, which was this reform wing that opposed the aristocratic trappings of New York. I don't want to say Victorian. This is obviously before Victorian era.
We watch a lot of Gilded Age, so I'm kind of picturing something like that, even though it's a little bit later, I think, then.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's exactly. And I think that kind of really goes to Martin Van Buren's, simple upbringing and the bootstrapping. And again, it's similar with Jackson, where you want to like the guy.
He's talking about, the way that is the old money in New York, the way it used to, I don't know, want to shun the people who made their money by themselves. There's this weird animosity between them. Yeah, 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 yeah. You didn't come from money, so you don't know what it's like to be rich, and you can't hang out with us in our
essentially what's going on in Virginia at this time.
Right.
What Jefferson was doing actively at the same exact time point.
Such a weird thing. Isn't that such a weird thing? Why? I guess if wealth was the thing that made you special, and now it's not the thing that makes you special, you got to have something to cling to, maybe?
Yeah, that is sounds boring.
Right?
Right. But it is funny that he was a Jeffersonian who joined a reform wing to remove aristocracy from New York, where being a Jeffersonian was very clearly an aristocracy move. I don't think a lot of these people have
the common man, Jeffersonian.
Yeah, right. The guy playing the violin. I do think this is something where people get so worked up about, the society's, all in a bad spot right now and all stuff. I'm like, no, everything, that's the best thing about, shows that we do, right, is that everything's the same. People yell at each other today and be like, your political, look at the hypocrisy of your political opinions. Don't worry. It was going on 200 years ago. It'll be going on 200 years from now.
This is not the best example, though, because this one kind of leads to
literal civil war. Yeah. That's why I was driving to the airport. I was getting driven to the airport before I went on vacation a few weeks ago, and we're getting a discussion with the driver, and she was really funny, but she kept talking about how awful the world is, we never been more divided, and I just got angry. And I said to her, "We had a civil war."
Yeah,
and she had an Eastern European accent, and she was like, "Yeah," I was like, "No, no," just like,
yeah, stop
for
right
the
there
record, yeah. We squared up. We drew
shot
a line.
Each other.
Yeah, we drew a line, and we then fought each other over whether or not it's okay to own people. I get it. Things may not be going great right now. You may not like what's going on right now. But again, we fought a war over whether or not you could own people. And we fought it north versus south.
The country has been more divided.
There are tortoises that are still alive that were alive when that was a thing. Can go to St. Helena right now and fist bump Jonathan the Turtle, who was in his 30s when this, I'm in my 30s, so you could go fist bump something was alive when this was a thing.
There was a show that I was watching, or I saw something pop up on my YouTube feed. It was I think it was a clip from I've Got a Secret or something along those lines, and the guy that they got on there was actually at the theater, Ford's Theater, when John Wilkes Booth assassinated Lincoln. And this is in the 60s. How insane is that?
Zachary Taylor, who we're going to cover in a little bit, has a grandson who's still alive. And he was president before the Civil War. So when he's saying the country's like, we've never been more divided. It's like, yeah, if you've never read, like if you've never like, if you've never like experienced history, I guess like maybe even like I think in my lifetime, I feel like we've been more divided. I feel like I could probably pick a couple times. So that's one of the things where I like, you know, Kyle and I discuss off air that we always hope for when we sit here and talk about this stuff is that like, you know, maybe it makes you a little happier because you realize we've been through a lot worse.
And it really does. It really does. Like, like history rhymes a lot, right? It doesn't always, yeah. It doesn't
history
always
doesn't
exactly
repeat,
repeat
but it rhymes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like there's been a lot of rhyming lately.
So Van Buren, you know, he's going through this legal practice, and in 1807 he meets his wife, and you know it's kind of cute because he married his like childhood best friend.
That's a meet cute.
Yeah. All right, Hannah. She's also Dutch descent, and. What's really funny is that like they still spoke Dutch in their house. So right. Like it wasn't just like Martin Van Buren grew up in his Dutch speaking household and then learned English and never used Dutch again. No, like when they had their four sons, Abraham, who's named after Martin Van Buren's father, John, and then Martin, mm-hmm. who is obviously named Martin Van Buren, and Smith, Smith Thompson, which I always like when they have two names. I think that's kind of cool. But unfortunately they're not married that long. Hannah ends up dying in 1819. So they're only married 12 years.
Yeah.
And she passes away at 35. And it really destroyed Van Buren, as you can imagine. So he never marries again.
Really? Oh, wow. Okay.
Never marries again.
Is this our first widower in office?
First widow. No, Andrew Jackson was a widower.
That's right. Yeah.
And so was Thomas Jefferson. Wow. Oh, my God. Are like half the presidents widowed? At this point?
Three of eight,
yeah, pretty close.
Yeah.
John
Adams. Oh, wow. Right. Yeah, okay.
Oh, huh. That's depressing. Oh, my God. Why are the presidents wicked sad? They're like, die young. And
parents die, yeah.
Are all the presidents Batman?
They all have seem to have an alcoholic son who, like, destroyed the family finances. And so which one of his kids was the
surprisingly not. I never got anything that, like, would make me think that any of his kids were bad. In fact, they all seem pretty close to their father. We're using contemporary. We're not, like, these sources weren't contemporary, so that's, I don't, footnote for everybody out there.
Is there anything still surviving of the Van Buren estate?
I believe so, but it wasn't as ostentatious as the other estates. So I know that, I believe the tavern's been preserved, but I also don't know how original that tavern is.
Right.
And a couple sources I looked at kind of disagreed with each other, so I didn't really like go into any exposition on it because I'll be honest, like some of the funny stuff, if you only have one source on it, I'm kind of like okay with it. If I'm like, hey, it's a goofy story,
yeah.
We're not So we'll move on to 1808, so a year after he marries Hannah, he gets he has his first public office. I almost said he got his first election, but he wasn't. He was actually appointed as a surrogate of Columbia County, which is basically like the probate officer for, you know, wills, estates. I think of like modern day probate.
Okay. So
it's what it eventually evolves into what we call modern day probate, but it's not too far off. He loved it. He absolutely loved it. So he ends up embracing the organizational side of politics. He's a really, really effective surrogate. And he's well respected in the role. And it's, you know, it's at this time that he really starts to develop some of his nicknames. And I think his most famous nickname.
You
know his most famous nickname?
I don't know any nickname. I didn't know he was famous for nicknames.
Oh yeah. One was cool, the Red Fox of Kinderhook, but that wasn't his famous one. The Little Magician.
Oh. Huh.
He's always known to be, like, impeccably groomed, and he was strategically patient, and he hated public discourse. He hated drama in the public, but he was a very effective negotiator behind the scenes.
So why did they give him the magician name? Because
I mean, maybe people did think he had magic powers back. That'd be fun.
I mean, if he was, like, really good at – I mean, if he's winning all these cases, if he's, like, a really good negotiator, maybe he's coming out and getting some deals that people don't expect.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there were so many different explanations of where he got the name, and like they were different. I hate when somebody's like, "This is where they got the name from." Like, there's like eight different ways. Long story short, he was known for negotiating backstage a lot of the stuff he did was, and he was very good at consensus building. So he'd make things appear when people reached impasses and nobody thought it could be solved. Martin Van Buren shows up and suddenly it appears, whatever they're trying to do. And he gets, I think that's cool. By the way, I think that's a cool nickname.
Basically a fixer.
So he does this job. He's really, really efficient at it. People actually like dealing with his office. He actually grew this idea of just being like really, really reliable. And I think that, you know, as somebody who worked in the public sector, I think that's one of the biggest compliments you get, that you're reliable and people want to deal with you. I mean, I think that's what people look for in government. And
I think
he ends
a good compliment wherever you work.
Yeah, that is true. And he ends up, what's funny is that he ends up like really understanding how the New York's council starts working, how their appointment system starts working. And he ends up being able to like advocate for, and I want to say this, this idea of like, because he's associated with Jackson, and Jackson's obviously the kitchen cabinet and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people like associate, like what I'm about to say, a lot of people will sometimes misconstrue it as like, oh, he was putting cronies in there. No, he's not, as much as I joke around, he's not Jackson, right? He's not Jackson. He ends up figuring out like how the appointment system works in New York and ends up advocating for a lot of people that he knows, but also these are competent people. These are not people he like just likes, like Jackson did. I'm going to keep firing the Secretary of Treasury till they do what I tell them to do. No, and these people end up staying in their roles like forever. And he slowly builds this pretty large-scale statewide power base.
Really?
Yeah, and it gets misconstrued sometimes that he was like, I'm only put my friends in the office. No, these people were qualified. Like, these were qualified people. Because at the end of the day, if there's anything Monroe hated, it was the aristocracy.
Right, right.
And he wasn't about to create political aristocracy, which is weird that he becomes aligned with Jackson. But it's important to remember at this point, he's still a Jeffersonian, and there is a huge difference between a Jeffersonian and a Jacksonian. There is a big difference there. And what ends up happening is, you know, Martin Van Buren continues to kind of develop, and by 1815, he's does something kind of unique. He's serving as a New York State Senator, but he's also the Attorney General for New York.
Wait, what? How does that work?
So in 1812, he gets elected as a state senator for New York. A state senator, not a U.S. senator for New York, but a state senator. And even but in 1815, what's up?
Even that seems a bit weird.
Oh, it's very weird. Yeah. And then in 1815, the governor appoints him as the New York Attorney General, which I think speaks like it's one of the few times it's ever happened in U.S. U.S. history, but it is interesting because I think it speaks highly to how Van Buren was viewed at this point of like, no, he's somebody who is known to be stoic, known to be patient and consensus builder, that he was allowed to do that without major opposition. New York is not like a one-party state at this point at all. I mean, you have Northern New York, New York City, that's kind of this like this business super, you know,
it's kind of the way it is now, where like you're like very liberal in the cities, and then once you get outside the cities, you get a little bit more conservative.
Yeah, I would think more manufacturing versus farming.
Okay.
But very similar, where there's that dichotomy there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's funny because he actually gained a lot of support because he was very vocal of supporting Madison during the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, if you know, the listeners remember the episode, that there was some contention there between the manufacturing North, the farming South. States like New York, Maryland, and Pennsylvania were kind of at those crossroads. But during this period, because remember, he's state senator in 1812, he actually is known to, he actually breaks a lot of party gridlock, and he helped create what the term they use is party discipline. So he kind of functioned almost like a whip. I guess you'd call it a whip in modern politics. But at the New York level, which is New York is right now just on the precipice of being the most important state.
So the picture you're starting to paint here is actually one of like a very competent person, Mr. Van Buren.
Very competent.
Very competent. But also, like, I got the impression from the earlier episodes that we were talking about, like, a protege of Jackson. But like, this sounds like he's his own man. Like, if it was a Jacksonian, like you said at the beginning, it makes sense that he really actually believed whatever he was involved in, because he seems not like the follower type from what we're talking about here.
So we don't start to see that happen until he serves in the U.S. Senate.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we start seeing it happening. So after his in 1820, after his time, he stops his time in the Senate. Let's put it that way.
Was there some sort of bargain?
Oh, a corrupt one. No. there was a little bit of a snafu. So he opposed at the time DeWitt Clinton was the governor of New York. And he really opposed. So Governor Clinton was kind of a cult personality guy in New York at this time. And Van Buren didn't really like that, which is kind of ironic considering how close he got to Jackson.
Mm.
And, he pragmatically supported some of the successful policies like of different infrastructure bills. Clinton did, such as like the Erie Canal and those types of development.
Yeah, okay.
But Monroe found himself being like critical of it, specifically the Erie Canal. So Martin Van Buren wasn't a huge fan of the Erie Canal. Awesome. Well, he didn't like how much executive authority that Governor Clinton was practicing at this point, which again, very weird.
Right?
Very weird that he would eventually become the protege of Jackson, because these are things he's openly, and primary sources are against kind of what Martin Van Buren was for his first 30 years. And that's a crazy thing to remember. It's 1820.
Yeah.
Martin Van Buren is like 37. Very young.
Yeah.
But 1821 ends, 1820 ends, 1821 begins something very interesting. Mr. Van Buren is sent to rewrite the Constitution of New York.
Really?
Yeah. And this is where we start to see the change of Van Buren. There's three major points I wanted to run through. It's not super interesting. It's not super important. If this was where the story ended, this is more like, here's the pivot just before he goes to the Senate in 1821. So he backed very, huge expansion of letting people vote to enfranchise. Oh, I don't know if it's franchise.
It's a fan of suffrage.
Yeah, suffrage is, let's just put it that.
Okay.
So Martin Van Buren comes in and he wants to expand white male suffrage. And that includes eliminating property tax testing, arguing that organized accountable parties could be responsible for channeling mass participation. Oh. So he's somebody who's seen the political machine. He believes it can be used for good.
So at this point, did you have to be a landholder in order to vote too?
Yes, in New York.
Okay.
But he simultaneously supported maintaining a property requirement for black votes, which was just very bizarre.
It's very obvious what that is.
Yeah. He was, make no mistake, he may have only owned one slave, but it wasn't like he was any less racist than anybody by day's standards.
I'm hoping he redeems himself by the end of his life.
We'll get there. We'll get there. He's not on Mount Rushmore.
Thanks for taking the hope away.
No. When you're arguing that you should be returning people to Spain, it's kind of weird.
Yep.
But overall, it was Van Buren's arguments of this like party machinery that, A, still affect New York to this day, but two, leads to a very stable adoption of this new New York Constitution, which, while it was horrible for black voters, overall increased the number of people voting. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that doesn't balance out. I'm not making that argument.
No.
But more people were voting afterwards, even if it was still an absolutely horrific way they applied it. But now we go to the change of Martin Van Buren, and actually it's a pretty quick... It's a pretty quick run before we close up his pre-presidency life, because in 1820, he's in the Senate from 1821 to 1828. By this point, he now knows how to run the political machinery. And I think this is where it becomes a little, we start to see that switch. Well, what's the old expression? Power corrupts, absolute power absolutely corrupts. And he ends up having this team of like editors and newspaper writers all over the nation that hype him up. And he runs kind of like the first tech bro campaign for federal office, where he's using like basically technology at the time, I guess, like the rapid introduction of the being able to print newspapers and how that system works, to paint himself in a favorable light. Mm-hmm. And he gets up there and he's in the U.S. Senate and he's doing stuff that actually sounds very federalist. He's favoring limiting federal power. He has skepticism towards federal funding internal improvements. Who does that sound like? Mm-hmm. Jackson. He has a very restrained tariff posture, very much aligned with the traditional Republican doctrine. Again, not Republicans today, the National Republicans.
Is this before or after the tariffs of abomination?
This is contemporary. So the tariffs of abomination are being proposed right now.
For them or against them?
At this point, he's against them.
Really?
But now he'll switch in 1824. So in 1824, he ends up having a horrific fracture within the Democratic Republicans. I mean, literally cataclysmic. And he didn't support Jackson. He actually supported William Crawford, mm-hmm. who was a congressional Republican nominee. I'm going to keep saying the word Republican. I mean National Republicans, which don't have anything to do with Republicans today. Modern Republican movement doesn't come around till Lincoln, till 5-10 years before Lincoln. Yeah. So we're nowhere near close to that.
We're getting there,
yeah. But he only supported Crawford because he wanted to preserve the party, because he believed in this, like, if the party machinery fails, everything else fails. So he was doing everything to preserve that. But then John Quincy Adams prevails, and Martin Van Buren kind of views this as a threat to this idea of, like, parties, not individual people, parties decide who wins and who loses. History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And he becomes not a National Republican, not a Democratic Republican, not a Jeffersonian, not even a Jacksonian yet. He becomes an anti-Adams, and he runs the anti-Adams coalition, and he just happens to gravitate around Jackson because he thinks Jackson has the best chance of defeating Adams.
Wow, really? So, no wonder why you hate Van Buren so much.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's like your literal supervillain.
Oh, and kind of as we close out towards his pre-presidential run, right? This is going to sound rapid fire, but because we have nothing else to say, because after this happens, once he latches on to Jackson, we covered everything already.
Right,
We covered everything already. He leaves the Senate in 1828, but he spends all of 1827 becoming the de facto national organizer for Andrew Jackson. He ends up returning to the governor of New York. He takes office in 1829, and he ends up doing all these economic reforms. But his signature initiative was something called the Safety Fund Banking System, which is like an early version of FDIC. Mm-hmm. And we'll see this during his presidency come back during the Divorce Act. But that should show how much aligning with Jackson kind of was like against his natural inclination, because he's in there trying to protect banks and allow for centralized holding.
This is after the Second National Charter got destroyed by Mr. Jackson. And like basically the whole free banking experiment of the Americas kind of failed during that whole period.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to describe it, guy. That's a very good way to describe it. But the idea of what he was doing with the safety fund was to support note holders. It wasn't to support the use of specie, but for note holding.
To protect the people.
Yeah, and we still have that. We still have FDIC to today. And there's an argument to be made. The reason we haven't had such bad recessions is because FDIC exists. He also endorsed all these internal improvements. He also got rid of debtor's jail in New York at the time, and created all these like super strong regulations involving people who are appointed to oversee finance, which again has New York's a big reason why New York is the financial capital of the world is Martin Van Buren's tenure as New York governor. Mm-hmm. He's only a New York governor for 2 years. He by 1829, so he's all of 1828, pretty much all of 1829. He ends up leaving. He ends up resigning in 1829 to become the Secretary of State. And Jackson loves him. Mm-hmm. He's known to be like
Why wouldn't he?
Yeah, but he's known to be more calming, easier to talk to, great consensus builder, which Jackson wasn't. But Jackson very much respected and trusted Van Buren. This was not an unbalanced relationship or a disrespectful relationship.
This was a bromance.
This is a bromance. Yeah, this is a good partnership. Yeah. One of our intros could be, Eric is the Martin Van Buren to Kyle's Andrew Jackson, but obviously we don't like Jackson that much.
No, I consider that, and I immediately swapped it out for something different. Well, do you have anything? Sorry, are we getting to the end here?
So kind of as we move towards the end, we're going to obviously hit over to his vice presidency, but I thought, and I talked about this a little bit during the Jackson episode, which was when the Peggy Eaton affair happened and the entire cabinet resigned. This is an important context. Martin Van Buren didn't have a wife.
Right? Oh.
The Eaton affair was because
somebody Peggy cheating Eaton, with, yeah.
Oh, Peggy Eaton was like, they said she was like an adulteress.
Yes. Rumors and slander, right?
Yeah. And so because like, or polygamous, I guess, or I guess both.
Was sleeping with some other, the rumor was she was sleeping with some other cabinet member, right?
No, the rumor was she was married. She didn't officially have a divorce yet when she married the Secretary of War.
Eaton. Oh, is one of those again? The same exact thing? Oh, I thought
same thing
was...
happened to Rachel and Andrew, and that's why Jackson defended her so much. But important to remember that Madison didn't have a wife. So in terms of these circles that Eaton felt cut out from, and that Jackson, because of Rachel, really empathized with, Martin Van Buren was unaffected. He's like, well, I'm just like, nobody in my household is doing that. I'm not involved. Like, I'm not involved in this at all. He still chose to step down with all the other cabinet members so Jackson could reappoint a new cabinet.
Huh.
And that would end up with him becoming vice president of the United States. And it was very clearly seen that he was the heir apparent to inherit the Jackson momentum, whereas the Whigs would probably say the Jackson throne from King Andrew. Right. And he would spend essentially the entire second term of Jackson's presidency just preparing to be the next president. And that will kick off next episode on March 4th, 1837, with the inauguration of Mr. Van Buren.
That is such a bizarre way to get the vice presidency. So the vice president also resigned in that instance?
I think Mr. Calhoun would probably use a different term.
Probably.
But yeah, officially on the records, it's resigned.
It sounds like Martin Van Buren only resigned just so he can get the step up.
Yeah, Calhoun just immediately went back to South Carolina and started trying to figure out how to nullify federal laws. That's how I would handle that situation. Right? Yeah, maybe I would. Johnson, we'll do a couple shorts on Calhoun, and people will be like, for a man with a great last name, what an interesting character.
All right, well, I think this is probably as good a place as any to put a pin in this episode. So please join us next week as we continue pulling on the strings that control Mr. Jackson's Van Buren, Mr. Martin Van Buren's presidency. While you're waiting for that, please drop your comments with your favorite Dutch people from history so we can wash the taste of this presidency out of our mouths. Drop in the comments for the world to see, or email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com, or you visit the website buckstartsherepodcast.com. Know thus to stay up to date. See you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.